they're quite frustrated just playing the PlayStation or the Xbox, and they believe that going out to somewhere like Syria actually fulfills that duty in a physical sense.
A British Muslim uses a cartoon avatar to dissuade vulnerable young men from joining ISIS. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Also on the show, the CDC says that Ebola cases could spike to 1.4 million by January, the operative word being could.
The problem here is that a lot of the media coverage didn't put as part of their headline or the lead that this is highly unlikely that we're going to see the worst case scenario.
And Zelda, an anonymous columnist offering sage advice for employees of the NSA.
Each one of these columns addresses a problem that you would see addressed in a Dilbert cartoon.
Yeah, if Dilbert were reading your emails and listening to your phone calls. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is off. I'm Bob Garfield. Here's what happened this week.
The Islamic State has released a second propaganda video featuring British freelance journalist John Cantley, in which Cantley warns U.S. efforts in Iraq and Syria could become another Vietnam.
In developing news, an Algerian group affiliated with the Islamic State released a video today showing the beheading of French hiker Hervé Gourdel.
With the gruesome ISIS propaganda war in full force, the U.S. State Department is ratcheting up its own media campaign to deter potential ISIS recruits. The slogan, a play on the old standby, "Just Say No," is an admonition to the vulnerable. Think again, turn away. And there's an accompanying Facebook page, Twitter feed, and Tumblr filled with the imagery of brutality. There's also a video archly titled "Welcome to the Islamic State," a mirthless parody of extremist recruitment tactics.
هلموا فليست سوريا للسوريين وليس العراق للعراقيين.
Against a backdrop of gore and violence, the video takes a stab at irony, instructing the viewer to run, don't walk to ISIS, where you can learn useful skills blowing up mosques, crucifying and executing Muslims. Rows of beheaded corpses plus deep sarcasm, courtesy of the United States government. HBO's John Oliver.
And you are banking a lot on any potential militants understanding that that is sarcasm. Oh, you know what? I was just about to join ISIS, but then I saw your very clever video telling me to join ISIS, but using ironic juxtaposition of words and images to suggest that I should actually do the opposite.
U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies have identified about a dozen Americans who've gone to fight for ISIS in Syria. In Britain, the number of recruits is about 500. And in Britain, a homegrown cartoon character named Abdullah X is the face of a more grassroots approach to anti-extremism. He challenges his peers to consider what Islam really espouses. The creator of Abdullah X, who asked to remain anonymous, says that his character confronts the young men who are most vulnerable to the ISIS message.
So we call someone like him at that stage a jihadist or a keyboard warrior, someone who is online, offline, discussing stuff in fast food outlets and college canteens.
Is that a matrix and thing? They got us on lock, making us believe we're free in that, but we're just robots. Exactly, my brother. Listen to the cause, to the call of revolution.
The particular journey that we're talking about, Abdullah X ends up realizing that some of the rhetoric, narrative, ideology, the anger, the hatred espoused by Islamism is in complete contradiction to the core teachings of Islam. And so he reverses the radicalization process by coming to realization.
And what you do is take Quranic language that has been abused by extremists and try to reframe it in the proper perspective.
Yes, the whole Abdullah X platform is about not trying to recontextualize the classic doctrine, but trying to give it the context that befits it in the 21st century.
And you're not afraid to be kind of harsh on the subjects of this kind of appeal. You talk about how their lives are disappointing them, they're seeking greater meaning, and somehow they let themselves invest meaning in what is really just mindless violence and random hatred.
Have you asked yourself sincerely what your actual maqasid, objective is, and if this is actually anything to do with Islam or protecting other people? If you have, then have you not found more constructive ways to support the innocent people of Syria compared to trying to go out there and fight to simulate some video game that you feel you have to reenact in real life?
There is an element there that needs to be brought to the attention of these keyboard warriors who then live out the Call of Duty mantra, which is they're quite frustrated just playing the PlayStation or the Xbox, and they believe that going out to somewhere like Syria actually fulfills that duty in a physical sense. So this camaraderie, this adventurism, this thrill-seeking needs to be contextualized. You have to look at some of the drivers and forces that might compel someone to do that. And unless you're going to attract their attention through talking directly to them, it's a hopeless task.
Now, this is not mere guesswork on your part. It's not the result of focus group data. You've been there.
Yeah, I've been there. I thankfully never got to the stage where I needed to act upon the anger and hate that had been created in me. But the truth about this is, yes, from the Russian invasion of Afghanistan in the mid to late 80s, to Bosnia, to Chechnya, to Kashmir, to Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, I've lived through those. I understand what drives people to adopt this very harsh, literalist interpretation of Islam. So, yeah, when we're talking about why would you talk to people a certain way, it's only because I bought the T-shirt and got a refund.
You were kind of pre-radicalized for the convenience of whoever was trying to recruit you. But they didn't quite succeed. What happened?
The same thing that I'm desperately hoping happens to a lot of young people around the world who are at the moment typing strange things into Google search engine, like how to go to Syria for jihad. That what happened to me was I saw through the motives, the legitimacy of the authority of the leaders of these networks and groups. I saw that they were willing to send other people's children off to death while they sit comfortably and survey these things from the rear. Secondly, was that I had to offset some of the vitriolic rhetoric, the hate and the anger that literalism and Islamism often espouses, by finally coming to terms with what does Islam say about things like the treatment of non-Muslims and Muslims? What does Islam say about my relationship as a British Muslim living in a secular country that is run by democracy? What rights do I have? What obligations do I have? Is it really as simple as saying there is no man-made law that I can accept? Unless we impose God's law physically and potentially violently, we can never rest. Is it all as simple as this narrative? And obviously, after 1400 years of development, it's not that simple. And the last thing that happened as a result of that journey of critical questioning was that I finally managed to come to terms with my own sense of identity, my own sense of belonging, my own sense of loyalty and duty. What I didn't believe in anymore was just this narrative and what this narrative was making people do.
In my introduction, I mentioned this State Department video, which kind of unaccountably takes an ironic approach, ridiculing the underlying premises of ISIS and other Muslim extremist organizations.
To be honest, having seen the video, to me, it just looks like an ISIS advertising video. The gore on its own and the violence, it would make that young man just sit there and go, you know what, now I want to see a real ISIS video. We have to also look on the role that Western governments have played in exacerbating and often directly or indirectly contributing to development of these very same risks and threats that we face from these networks. Grievances don't die. You know, they get passed down from generation to generation. And we have to therefore ask ourselves, or the viewer would have to ask, how credible is the message of the US government when telling Muslims about other Muslims and their behavior and their actions?
Are you suggesting that whatever tactic is taken, whatever messaging tactic, the fact that it comes from the US Department of State immediately renders it not only ineffective, but sort of putting gasoline on the fire of extremism?
Your answer is in the communication sent from ISIL. The truth is they turn this into more campaigning for their own cause. The communication sent out very early Tuesday morning from the appointed theologian that represents ISIS plays heavily on the fact that the US president and other people around the world in positions of power and authority are apparently trying to tell Muslims which Muslims they should believe in, which Muslims they should support.
You touched on one other thing I want to explore. unlike, let's say, Catholicism, where the Pope represents a central authority, there is no central theological authority in Islam. Is there any way for a third party to fill that yawning gap of authoritative interpretation to undermine these perversions of Islamic law at the source?
For many years now, there have been amazing efforts by mainstream Muslim organizations, individuals, imams, and clerics to make sure that Muslim communities themselves are resilient. They understand what Islam's core message is, and they understand how to live in non-Muslim societies, for example. The biggest problem we have when we talk about who speaks for Islam, it is often Western media's almost now Islamophobic diatribe that does not highlight the grassroots efforts of mainstream law-abiding Muslim communities and those in authority over them. It doesn't highlight that work. And even in the United States, there are incredible efforts at community level always going on. It's just that for some reason, we like to show the monsters, and that's why Abdullah X was born.
I must ask, are you funded or in any way connected directly or indirectly with, I don't know, MI6 or any UK agency?
Abdullah X is a self-funded project of myself and a few like-minded people. I'd like it to remain that way. Abdullah X is a brother, Bob, who's just had some interesting experiences. And what he's trying to do is he wants to show people that, listen, whether you're a US soldier or whether you're out there in Raqqa somewhere or on the border between Syria and Iraq, you know, you need to think twice about sometimes your motives, what your intentions are, and who you really think you're doing this for. Abdullah X is a citizen of the world, God willing. He's not trying to toe any particular line. He's just saying that at the end of the day, if a Muslim believes that a Muslim's life is governed by sanctity, then the prophetic tradition is also that a non-Muslim's life is governed by the same sanctity as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bob.
The creator of Abdullah X and anti-extremist cartoon series, we will link to it on our website. Coming up, does propaganda by gunpoint work? This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week brought another disturbing video of British ISIS hostage John Cantley spouting ISIS propaganda in the style of a broadcast news commentary, if commentators wore orange jumpsuits. Last week, this program aired three short excerpts from the first Cantley tape. Another news outlet, however, did not. CNN, on the grounds of not wishing to give a propaganda platform to terrorists. To have done so, said Tony Maddox, the executive vice president of CNN International, would have been to be complicit in torture.
The starting point with all these things is you don't want to run them. If you think that a group such as ISIS, which is a wicked organization, I normally avoid giving value judgments against different groups involved in world affairs, but I'm afraid ISIS are off the clock. And with the Cantley video, I just simply thought, well, this man is clearly performing to save his life. It is a disgusting spectacle. He's saying nothing that we haven't heard before. We should certainly say that he's done it and certainly show a still from it. But why would we then go on and actually run the video itself and show this unbelievably demeaning, humiliating footage?
I just want to be clear. It's not just that you didn't want to give a platform to the terrorists. It was the particular nature of this kind of video, which, while not a beheading, was kind of grisly in its own right.
I'm a great believer in we shouldn't censor and we should show the full story, even if it is disturbing and even if it is ultimately in the interest of the people who've committed the act of badness. A good example I can think of is a story we did a lot on earlier this year with the schoolgirls who were taken from Chibok. Footage appeared of all the girls lined up in the full garb and this guy ranting and raving away at the front. I thought that was an image that the world had to see.
These were the Nigerian school children who were kidnapped by Boko Haram.
That was a story that we committed to. We went to Chibok, and it was important that the world saw that image, as disturbing as it was. We are CNN. We are in the business of arresting and powerful images. But I'm saying we should always weigh up, why are we showing this? What is the editorial purpose that is achieved in doing so? With the Cantley video, I wasn't sure what that was. We have no way of knowing if that's genuinely what he felt or if he was saying it because he's under the imminent threat of death. He's not a well-known figure, so I thought this was an occasion where we wouldn't need to show it. The next time, those circumstances could be different, and then we would. We have these editorial debates all the time. Actually, some very powerful counter-arguments were offered.
And what were they?
The fact that they've changed their strategy now from a beheading to actually making like a news-type video is in itself quite interesting, and I think that's a fair point.
I want to ask you about something you said, that it's clear that he has been coerced. To me, what's so chilling about the Cantley videos is that it isn't clear that he has been coerced. You get the feeling that he has written this stuff. He doesn't sound like a terrorist lunatic. On the contrary, he's making some fairly cogent points about the West's strategy in dealing with ISIS. I wonder if you are concerned that the video would actually persuade the audience that maybe it is best to leave these people alone.
No, I'm not convinced by that at all. There are all kinds of counter-arguments against, you know, U.S. strategy and elsewhere, and we've got all kinds of people who can powerfully argue that on CNN, CNN International, and NPR, and that's fine. And we absolutely should be seeking out those voices, but we shouldn't be seeking out the voices of people under threat of death.
TV news and print news as well is very much in the business of feeding the public's appetite for the kinds of very disturbing images that we're discussing now, and our jobs are frequently about where to draw the line. I wonder if the calculus that you applied to this decision will affect how you look at all such compelling images henceforth.
People shouldn't think we just did it just for this one video. I started in journalism a long time ago as a senior editorial figure, if you like, in Northern Ireland in the mid-90s. And I've been dealing with these kinds of ethical and editorial dilemmas ever since. And one thing I can tell you is they don't really get that much easier. If anything, they get more complicated. I'm always very uncomfortable with people who view these things in such clear black and white terms. I think a lot of people who are choosing to run a lot of this stuff candidly aren't even discussing it at all. It's just good footage and we're putting it up and then just step back and say, oh, we let the audience decide. People shouldn't be afraid to actively discuss these things on a case-by-case basis. I think people just like to get too easy and say, oh, we never do this, or we always do that, or we should never do this, or we should always do that. And my concern, my wider concern really, is that sometimes I just don't think that debate takes place.
Tony, thank you so much.
No problem at all.
Tony Maddox is the Executive Vice President of CNN International. So we asked on Twitter how you, our listeners, wanted mainstream news outlets to treat material released by terror organizations. Now we'll hear from three of you: Nathan Hankins, a hospital security officer in Jackson, Wyoming; Scott Westman, an Atlanta lawyer; and Karen Hagen, a Louisville veterinarian. Hey, everyone. Welcome to On the Media.
Hi.
Thank you.
Hello.
I'll poll you individually first. What images have you seen, Nathan?
I've seen the beheading videos and the two lectures.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Scott?
I have seen the Soltlov and the Haynes beheading videos.
And Karen?
I have seen stills of the beheadings and the Cantley stills. I do not want to watch any of the beheadings.
Any of you face any obstacles in trying to see any portion of this material that you did decide to view?
This is Scott. I think I probably would have watched the Foley video when it initially came out, but by the time I sort of realized that it had happened, it had been scrubbed from Twitter and from basically every other mainstream news outlet.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Scott, that news organizations should do with the videos? Should they air them come what may? Should they withhold them? What?
I look at it as a question somewhat of the broadcast type. If it's something that is going to be shown essentially indiscriminately to anyone who happens to pass by the TV, for example, nightly news, then I think that there's a different standard that is in order from a site where you have to click to decide whether you want to watch it.
So you think that if a social network scrubs a video of a beheading from its site, that it's acting paternalistically and to your disadvantage?
Very much so. They don't know why I want to view it, or why I've chosen to, at least.
and to make a blanket decision that no one could benefit from this or that society is better if this video is not viewed is to jump to all kinds of conclusions about what the video does to people, what it is meant to do, and essentially who wins when the video is displayed or not.
Nathan, you said that because the videos are online, you wanted ordinary news outlets to report on them to provide you the context that you need to process the images. What did you mean?
Well, I guess I want news to provide context, not just for me, but for anybody viewing them. You know, what ends up happening is it ends up being pushed to the farthest reaches of the internet, and then when I go looking for it, I end up finding it's cast in like a conspiracy light or something along those lines, and I want to see it so that, you know, I want to get context from the professionals.
Karen, I want to ask you, you only saw stills from the videos. You felt you'd seen enough. Can you tell me why you limited your consumption just to stills?
I feel like we're actually playing into the extremist hands by propagating the message. We've become a messenger for their propaganda by showing these videos. Just by over and over having these on YouTube or Twitter or anything like that, I feel like their availability is allowing their message to become more available. Hmm. We've become part of the propaganda machine.
Now, that, of course, sets you up directly apart from Scott, who doesn't want paternalistic news organizations making his consumption decisions for him.
And most of the time, I would completely agree. I definitely don't want to live in a nanny state. But in this case, I feel like they want us to show everyone the violence that they're capable of. And the more people that see it, the happier they're going to be about it. Why should we make them happy?
Nathan, I want to bring up something that is maybe a little confrontational. And it has to do with context that you described before, your desire for news organizations to sort of help sort this out for you. There's also another phenomenon, and that's kind of human bloodlust. Whatever that impulse is that makes you turn your head to see the wreckage on the highway in case there's some gore there, that makes us look at beheading videos as a sort of terror porn. Having viewed some of this stuff, do you ever feel personally, I don't know, dirty?
yeah, absolutely. To some degree, it's what, you know, Karen was saying about whether I'm playing into their hand, or like you said, just whether I'm, you know, giving into baser instincts. I guess I just want to see it for myself, because if I'm getting it from, you know, what other people said they saw, or, you know, the site that says that it didn't really happen or that it was some kind of a government conspiracy, they get their way. I think the bloodlust is going to be used by somebody, so I want news agencies that I have more faith in to be able to provide context to better inform people.
Some of what we've witnessed from ISIS is just kind of unfathomable on every level. Do you think that the experience you've had over the past couple of weeks looking at this material has actually added to your understanding of the geopolitics of radical Islam, particularly in the Middle East, and of religious doctrine versus just plain extremism? Do you know more than you did before for having viewed this stuff?
Obviously, I want to say yes. I just have to say no, I didn't. I don't think specifically watching those videos I gained anything.
Scott?
Oh, I definitely think that I did. As horrifying and unpleasant as it is to witness something like that, I think that I learned to see a propaganda video for what it is. From my view, anyway, there was a certain clumsiness to the videos that I would not have been able to see if I had simply taken a CNN anchor's description at face value. There's a certain ham-handedness to the speech that the victims are required to give. And what I'm left with, of course, is the horror of this evil act, but at the same time, a sense of the humanity that pervades the entire scene. And in some ways, it tempered some of the instinctive fear that I had when I thought about ISIS and the horrible things that they're doing.
Karen, your patients are absolutely out of control. What kind of operation are you running there?
Do you hear them barking? I'm so sorry.
Let me ask you on the flip side, Karen, not having looked at the most gruesome images, do you feel somehow deprived of nuance, texture, and a kind of a visceral reaction that might help inform your understanding of what the hell is going on in the world?
Gosh, no, I don't feel deprived. We already know that these people are barbarians. Do I need to see a beheading to know what happened in a beheading? No, I don't need to see it. We already know that they're capable of all kinds of terrible acts. You know, just because it's happening to Westerners now doesn't mean they haven't treated women terribly. Now that Western journalists have become targets, now we're all paying attention.
Hmm. It sounds to me like we've played to a draw. I can draw a triangle of your positions. Is the answer that there is no hard and fast answer? And what do you say to my assertion that we just have to call them as we see them as the stories erupt?
This is Karen. That's why you got the big bucks, I suppose.
No, ma'am. I'm in public radio.
Yes, I realize that.
Nathan?
Absolutely. And I appreciate you providing me with that cop-out.
Well, I'm here to serve, Nathan, to protect and serve. Thank you, one and all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
We just heard Nathan Hankins of Jackson, Wyoming, Scott Westman of Atlanta, Georgia, and Karen Hagen, an apparently very successful veterinarian in Louisville, Kentucky. The videos of John Cantley aren't the first time a captive has been used to deliver propaganda to the American public. In January 1968, the USS Pueblo, a Navy spy ship, was on a mission to locate military radar stations along the coast of North Korea when it was fired upon and captured by North Korean forces. One crew member was killed, and the remaining 82, led by Commander Lloyd Bucher, were taken hostage. Jack Cheevers wrote a book about the Pueblo incident called Act of War and described what happened to the captive crew.
They were interrogated, tortured, subjected to very intense pressures for 11 months. They were forced to sign false confessions saying that the ship had intruded into North Korean territorial waters, which was not the case. They were forced to take part in staged press conferences where they repeated all the propaganda messages that the North Koreans wanted them to repeat.
Well, here's what it sounded like in 1968.
We, the officers, crew, and civilian oceanographers of the USS Pueblo, are writing you jointly to explain the facts and those points we consider pertinent to our capture. Specifically, that we intruded into the territorial waters of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and committed hostile acts, and sincerely apologizes for these acts and gives assurance that they will not be repeated.
You know, I think I was only a sixth or seventh grader at the time, but I vividly remember being horrified at what I knew to be the torture and coercion that led Commander Bucher to make these statements. But I was also kind of relieved because I understood that the adult world could see right through the charade. Did I have it right?
I think you had it exactly right. The North Koreans, especially during the early days of the crisis, basically forced Bucher and other crew members to mouth their propaganda as written by the North Koreans. And they weren't very particularly good at writing English. The syntax and grammar were mangled. Let me just pick out one sentence from his very first confession. It says, "The U.S. Central Intelligence Agency promised me that if this task would be done successfully," he's referring to the spy mission, "a lot of dollars would be offered to the whole crew members of my ship, and I particularly myself would be honored."
It sounds kind of like the mistranslated Japanese T-shirts that find their way on the internet.
Right.
Well, as if it weren't already obvious, the captives found ways to signal to the American public that underneath this was coercion.
Absolutely. My favorite bit of resistance on the part of the Americans was when they flipped off the North Koreans whenever a camera was pointed in their direction. The Koreans would ask, well, what does this gesture mean? And the Americans would say, oh, that's just the Hawaiian good luck symbol. To give the story credibility, the men would flip each other off at mealtimes and when they were doing calisthenics and give a big smile, and the North Koreans didn't catch on for months. There's a group picture of them taken one day where three or four of the men are actually flipping the bird. And the picture ran on the front page of a number of American newspapers. Unfortunately, Time magazine explained in the photo caption exactly what this gesture meant, and the entire crew was beaten on and off for a period of a week.
1968 was a tough year for the American public, loss of innocence-wise. It would see the Tet Offensive later in January, two assassinations, Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. But it all began with the spectacle of an American naval officer confessing crimes on television. How did the public react to those images?
This was a new experience for the American public. The first televised hostage drama, if you will. And a lot of people favored the use of military force, and the government actually had some contingency plans for using nuclear weapons if war broke out on the Korean Peninsula. But a lot of people were very wary about seeing the Pueblo incident erupt into a second war in Asia. This was during the height of the Vietnam War, and the last thing a lot of people wanted was to see another war break out in Korea. So there was a lot of pressure on President Johnson to resolve the crisis peacefully.
The video that we're seeing now of British journalist John Cantley under threat of being beheaded is a kind of bravura performance. He sounds earnest. The language sounds like his. I wonder if there's a difference how the public will process that sort of thing with how it understood the Pueblo propaganda.
The Cantley video is certainly a masterpiece of propaganda, but I think the North Koreans got their money's worth out of the Pueblo crew as well. And their message was that the United States had sent a spy ship into their waters. This was a prelude to a very vicious and aggressive effort by the United States to launch another war against them. And the United States had to apologize for doing that and promised never to do it again in order to get its crewmen back. And in fact, the United States did sign a form of apology after it had tried every other negotiating gambit to get the crew back.
I understand that it turned out to be a propaganda bonanza for the North Koreans. But as to the confessions themselves, when they are so clearly done under threat of torture or worse, what is the point? If nobody believes that the confessions are genuine, why does any captor bother with the exercise to begin with?
One goal of the North Koreans was simply to humiliate the United States. And if North Korea could broadcast films and photographs of the Americans confessing, that would carry a message into not only the socialist nations of the day, but the Third World as well. The other thing is the psychological impact on the American public. The men were forced to write letters home to their relatives, for instance. They would say things like, please get in touch with your local congressman, please get in touch with the President of the United States. Even though it's transparently coerced propaganda, it still does have a political impact.
To this day, the Pueblo is the tourist attraction in Pyongyang.
Right. And the North Koreans have this ship tied up behind their brand new Fatherland Liberation War Museum. When you go aboard, one of the first things you see is Commander Booker reading this false confession.
Jack, I thank you.
My pleasure, Bob.
Jack Cheevers is the author of Act of War, Lyndon Johnson, North Korea, and the Capture of the Spy Ship Pueblo. Matt Katz is a reporter for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. Last week, he found himself completely scooped on the biggest story on his beat, the so-called Bridgegate scandal featuring New Jersey governor and presumed presidential hopeful Chris Christie. The news was Christie was off the hook. The federal investigation was standing down. Naturally, Katz was obliged to run the story down, and he did. He so did. Here's the follow-up piece he ran.
It started innocently enough last Thursday night with a scoop from WNBC, the local affiliate in New York.
Federal officials tell us the Justice Department has found no evidence so far that Governor Christie had any idea about the plan to shut down lanes approaching the George Washington Bridge.
There's two important elements of this statement. First, so far. This indicated that the investigation is ongoing, as subsequent reporting by WNYC confirmed. The second, the anonymous officials told WNBC only that Christie didn't know about the plan to shut down the lanes, not whether he knew after the fact and tried to cover it up, a potential crime in itself. Nor does the story report on the status of other Bridgegate-related investigations, like that of the alleged shakedown of the Hoboken mayor over Sandiade, or the New York District Attorney's probe of possible illegal use of Port Authority funds to pay for repairs to the Pulaski Skyway in Jersey City. And yet, here's how Brian Williams interpreted this anonymously sourced story on NBC Nightly News.
The federal charges are now ruled out for Chris Christie in the affair that came to be known as Bridgegate.
Then, the Washington Post jumped aboard. It ran two stories, headlined, "Today is a very good day for Chris Christie," and "Attention GOP 2016 hopefuls, Chris Christie is poised to reclaim frontrunner status." The latter story said that Christie was, quote, no longer a target of the federal investigation, even though nobody has come forward to say that, either anonymously or otherwise. Williams had to retract his story Friday night.
We may have added confusion to some complex legal reporting here last night.
It has to do. Well, it wasn't a retraction exactly, but a clarification.
The state of play is this. The feds have so far found no grounds for charges, no involvement of the governor himself. Both the federal and state investigations continue.
The Washington Post media critic Eric Wemple slammed NBC News for its reporting, but didn't mention that his paper had made the same mistake. The Post changed the lead of one of its stories online, but didn't acknowledge the error other than to note that the story had been altered from its original version. After the WNBC story, Christie told listeners of NJ 101.5 FM's Ask the Governor show that he wasn't surprised by the report.
What matters most to me is that the people in New Jersey know that I tell them the truth. They don't always have to agree with me, and they don't always agree with me. And it doesn't mean that we'll never make a mistake, because obviously that's not true either. But I've told them the truth.
Christie's office emailed a clip of those comments to reporters, and the YouTube video has already been viewed 2,500 times. Christie attended services at New Hope Baptist Church in Newark, where Pastor Joe Carter told the crowd that the governor had been cleared.
Is you cleared of all that nonsense? Amen.
Pastor Carter told the governor that he was praying for him and his family.
The New Hope Baptist Church is praying for him and all the children. Amen. God bless you.
The following day, Christie returned to the campaign trail, where he'll raise money and stump for Republicans in six states in 8 days. For WNYC, I'm Matt Katz.
Matt Katz joins me now. Hey, Matt.
Hi, Bob.
Now, your piece ends talking about how Governor Christie is out on the hustings raising money for the Republican Governors Association, but he is also raising profile for Chris Christie for whatever his presidential ambitions may be, eh?
He'll be in Ohio, for example, in a few days, and they do not have a competitive gubernatorial election, and yet they are a crucial state for the presidential election. When he goes to these places, he meets with the local reporters, with all the big donors of those particular states. This is as good of a preparation you can have if you want to run for president.
There is a lot of research about what happens when misinformation gets out there. Despite the apology by Brian Williams and the corrections, such as they've been, in the papers, don't you suppose that people still think Chris Christie was exonerated?
For sure. There was a headline prompted by the NBC and Washington Post reports on the top of Drudge that was up there for a good 12 hours, and it said, Christie launches comeback in all capital letters. I mean, even before this came out, because it hadn't bubbled up in the national news media for a month or two, regular folks I talked to, Republicans out in the country, thought that they hadn't gotten anything on him. And he has, for all intents and purposes, been exonerated because he was out there once.
Now, as a practical matter, especially if you're running for president, if you ride the wave of exoneration for a while and you get indicted, it kind of doesn't matter what confusion existed in the months before that.
I think that's why he didn't go out there and make a hugely victorious speech after this happened. It's more helpful for assuring donors and big-time Republicans privately. Like, listen, you know, you've seen the news. I'm clear of this thing. That maybe makes them less likely to go toward other so-called moderate Republicans like Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney to try to get them in the race. What it really does for him now is assure the powers that be behind the scenes that everything is cool.
Except that we have no reason to think that one way or another, right?
We have one report from federal officials who may or may not be investigators handling this case that so far they have no evidence on one piece of one scandal that is being investigated.
I would be remiss to let you go without asking if you have any insight into how the investigation is going, state and federal, and whether there are any rumblings in the courthouse.
The federal investigation has been really under seal. The only other leak that came out turned out to be false as well. In January, right after Bridgegate broke, the New York Times sent out a breaking news alert via text and email that said that the guy who shut down the lanes, David Wildstein, had evidence to show that Christie was guilty. And then they ended up having to change their lead. All he said was that evidence exists somewhere. As far as the state investigation, it doesn't appear that they have any evidence to indicate that Christie ordered this thing, but there is a lot of smoke about whether him and his people tried to kick this under the rug. And that's why the limitation of the WNBC scoop was so significant, because it didn't say anything about the cover-up.
For our breaking news consumers handbook, would you suggest a Christie addendum which says if you see a story referring to the Christie investigation, don't bother reading it. It's wrong.
I would wait until Paul Fishman, the U.S. attorney in New Jersey, comes out one way or another and says something. They are certainly going to have to make some sort of statement if they decide not to indict him.
Matt, thanks.
Sure, Bob.
Matt Katz covers Governor Chris Christie for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. Coming up, when spies get spied on, it really saps morale. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. On Tuesday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released a report predicting a sharp rise in new Ebola infections. In the worst-case scenario, 1.4 million total cases by January. The worst-case scenario, however, presumes that the international community entirely ignores the outbreak. It hasn't. On Thursday at the UN, President Obama said that a military command was up and running in Liberia's capital, moving in equipment and people to set up treatment units and train healthcare workers to contain the virus. This on top of previous containment measures. But Ebola bleeds, and if it bleeds, it leads, with headlines destined to alarm. The New York Times, The Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal all published stories shouting that Ebola cases, quote, could reach 1.4 million within 4 months. And then there's the TV.
Grim prediction today regarding the Ebola virus. In a new study, the World Health Organization predicted that the death toll from the outbreak could hit 21,000 people in just the next 6 weeks.
The Ebola outbreak has been especially troubling because there's no way to treat it or prevent the virus from spreading.
And the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, says that cases could balloon to as many as 1.4 million by mid-January.
This all played out to the horror, but not necessarily the surprise, of Laura C., assistant professor of government at Colby College and blogger for The Washington Post. C. says that the source of the hysteria was the CDC, but the blame is another matter.
For the CDC, they're a government agency, and it's a responsible thing for them to model the worst-case scenario. They need to plan for every possible contingency in this particular epidemic. So they should have done it, and as a government agency, that's probably information that doesn't meet the classification requirements, and so it has to be a matter of public record. I think the problem here is that a lot of the media coverage sort of set aside or didn't put as part of their headline or the lead that, you know, this is highly unlikely that we're going to see the worst case scenario.
Those headlines do employ the conditional could.
Right.
But a meteor could strike Earth next week.
Right,
Russia
right.
could nuke Europe. The Cowboys right. could reach the Super Bowl. Likelihood is another matter altogether.
Well, you know, as a Cowboys fan, I have to say, unfortunately, that's true.
Well, let's just agree that the Washington Post and the New York Times and many other news organizations who talked about the possibility of 1.4 million were indiscreet. But they are pikers compared to Bloomberg Businessweek. Can you tell me about the cover of the most recent issue?
It says Ebola is coming, and that's essentially the cover. But it's not written just in plain type. It is a graphic design where the words Ebola is coming look like they've been written on a wall in blood. And there's a couple of problems with this.
Starting with, Ebola is not coming.
It's not coming to the United States. Now, I think it is important for people to understand there is a chance that we could have, you know, a minimal number of people who have been in West Africa, who got infected but were not yet symptomatic. The incubation period can be anywhere from 2 to 21 days with Ebola. And they get back home in the States and they start to show symptoms. They go to an emergency room and they're diagnosed with Ebola. That could happen, but it's the what happens next that makes the difference between a West African-style scenario and what we would see in the United States. We have a very strong public health system, including a very strong infectious disease response system. There are plans to isolate patients very quickly, to trace everyone they've come into contact with. We have facilities all across the country that are equipped to handle Ebola or another highly infectious disease. There's not going to be an Ebola epidemic in the United States. It's not going to be something that people are having to flee their homes to get away from.
It's not casually transmitted. It's only done by contacting body fluids of a living or dead victim.
Direct contact with bodily fluids. And, you know, most of us are never going to find ourselves in that kind of scenario. So that's one problem with the cover, is that it's inaccurate. And I would add that it doesn't actually reflect the content of the cover story, which is quite good and is not sensationalistic at all. It's just the cover image that is particularly, you know, misleading. The other problem with this, though, is, you know, when you start to use blood, okay, bleeding from bodily orifices is something that happens to Ebola patients in the end stages of the disease, right before they die. But using that kind of blood and associating it with this disease, it's a threat, it's coming from Africa, that harkens back to a long history of tropes about Africa as this diseased and dirty continent. It's the heart of darkness, and who knows what could come out of there. And in a worst-case scenario, this is something that consciously or subconsciously contributes to discrimination and prejudice against people of African ancestry in our country.
Reading between the lines, you didn't like this cover.
Not a big fan, although I will say that it was slightly better than the Newsweek cover that ran in late August, which featured a chimpanzee and a similar threat about could African immigrants bring Ebola to the United States through illegally imported bushmeat. That's never going to happen, and they couldn't actually find any evidence that it would, but they use this imagery, you know, that harkens back to like a time during the colonial period when Africans were equated with primates, when they were seen to be savages, and this all served as a justification for colonial oppression.
Laura, who's doing a great job?
I think Gina Moore at BuzzFeed is doing a wonderful job. There is a Sierra Leonean reporter named Umaro Fofana. He is doing coverage for the BBC and some work for Reuters as well, and it has just been absolutely top-notch. Drew Henshaw at the Wall Street Journal and his team, you know, really sensitive reporting that respects the right of the victims, that doesn't oversimplify what's going on, and that doesn't rely on sensationalism just to get clicks on their stories.
Now, you've read the CDC report. What's your headline, and what do you think should have been the focus of the coverage?
Something like Ebola cases set to triple in the next month would have been a perfectly valid headline and a much more accurate one. I think another part of the story is, why did it take the global community so long? We have known that this outbreak was serious at least since June and July, and it's only now, almost in October, that we're starting to see the kinds of financial commitments that are necessary in order to stop and contain the disease. And I think it speaks to some of the realities of inequality in global health, of whose lives we prioritize more. When Americans, health workers and missionaries, started getting infected in July, we started to see more American media interest in the story. The only people to be evacuated so far are people who are Americans, citizens of various European countries. A couple of weeks ago, a Sierra Leonean doctor, Dr. Olivette Buck, died of the disease after her government had spent a large portion of the week fighting with the World Health Organization, begging them to evacuate her, and the WHO refused to evacuate her, and so she died. And for Sierra Leone, that's not just a question of one more person dead, that's losing a doctor. Sierra Leone has a very limited number of health professionals, people who are trained and willing to respond to this crisis, but also the long-term problem of you know, what you do with your public health system after it's been devastated by an epidemic like this. And, you know, if Dr. Buck's life is not worth as much as the life of an American doctor, I think that says something really damning about us as a culture and about us as a people.
Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Laura C. is Assistant Professor of Government at Colby College and a blogger for the Monkey Cage blog of The Washington Post. And now on to something that touches us all, or most of us, problems at the workplace. Let's say you have unease at work because your coworkers and bosses are driving you crazy. Where do you turn? Well, at one outfit in suburban Maryland, they can turn to Zelda, the advice columnist on the company intranet. Zelda is anonymous not only because she's a coworker herself, but because she works for the National Security Agency. Yes, she is Dear Abby for spooks. Zelda's very existence was secret until it was revealed in the Edward Snowden leak and made public by The Intercept, the new investigative reporting site where Glenn Greenwald now works. Peter Moss wrote the story after reading Zelda's columns.
Each one of these columns addresses a problem that you would see addressed in a Dilbert cartoon. There's the employee who's mad because somebody is stealing his or her sodas from the communal fridge. There's somebody who's mad because an office mate smells. There's a complaint about somebody who speaks too loudly, about somebody who walks right next to their friend in the hallway, making it difficult for other people to pass by. There really is no bar too banal for the complaints at the NSA.
But some of these complaints are so thick with irony that it's just delicious. Can you give me some examples?
A lot of these complaints were about people at the NSA being spied on, and they didn't like it and thought something should be done about it.
Yeah. Can you read me a passage?
My favorite was written by somebody who referred to himself or herself as silenced in SID. SID refers to the Signals Intelligence Directorate, which is the heart of the beast at the NSA, the place where the major surveillance operations occur. And the column was headlined, "Watching Every Word in Snitch City." Dear Zelda, when the boss sees coworkers having a quiet conversation, he wants to know what is being said. It's mostly work-related. He has his designated snitches and expects them to keep him apprised of all the office gossip, even calling them at home and expecting a rundown. We're all afraid any offhand comment or anything said in confidence might be either repeated or misrepresented. Needless to say, this creates a certain amount of tension between team members who normally would get along well and adds stress in an already stressful atmosphere. It ended this way with this paragraph. This was once a very open, cooperative group who worked well together. Now we're more suspicious of each other, and teamwork is becoming harder. Do you think this was the goal? And it's signed, silenced, in SID.
The reason that it's so funny to hear that, of course, is because all you have to do is take out the words workers and put in citizens, and take out the word bosses and put in the word government, and you could be talking about the toll of the surveillance state, right?
Absolutely. There were several letters and responses from Zelda that were on this topic. Her responses indicated that she really did think privacy was pretty darn important. And I really do not know whether she was choosing these letters with this underlying agenda or whether indeed she was just talking about the NSA workplace.
In other words, you can't tell whether she just can't recognize the obvious irony or really quite subversive criticizing the agency right in plain view.
I guess like so many things at the NSA, we really don't know exactly what's up. What we do know is her responses could be allegories for the nation, the world at large, because she responds to that one letter by saying, wow, that takes intelligence collection in a whole new and inappropriate direction. We work in an agency of secrets, but this kind of secrecy begets more secrecy and becomes a downward spiral that destroys teamwork. What if you put an end to all the secrecy by bringing it out in the open? She said, trust is hard to rebuild once it has been broken.
Okay, now I have to ask you a question here, Peter. Are you so suspicious and so angry about violations of civil liberties that you are looking for deeper meaning in a story which is just kind of quirky and cute?
Of course. I'm a journalist, and I think lots of journalists are angry and suspicious, but hopefully self-aware enough to know that there's a difference between what you think and what you know. I don't know, what Zelda was trying to say, whether it was a broader message she was trying to send out or not. All I know is that what she did say was deeply ironic.
Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Moss wrote about Ask Zelda for The Intercept.
Dear Zelda, some coworkers and I have been exchanging messages that we, up until recently, believed to be private. In these messages, we said some embarrassing things about mutual acquaintances, including comparing one female coworker to Teflon and another pair of upper-level managers to Batman and Robin. Unfortunately, these messages weren't private at all. Someone posted them onto NSAnet, frowny emoticon. Now everyone hates me and my coworkers. What can we do to make people like us again?
Who hasn't done something like this? It's mortifying when it happens. But once it's out there, the damage is done. In time, people will forget it and move on. The best way to make people like you is to not say unflattering things about them in the first place and never put them in writing. That would be a good New Year's resolution for us all.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Sara Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Kimmy Regler. We had more help from Kasia Mihailovic, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.